how measurement works in the de Broglie-Bohm model. Let me just recap where we were. So we were considering a situation where we're making a measurement on a particle which is initially in a superposition of two wave packets. So the initial state is like so. Then we introduced a measurement apparatus with some pointer on it. So we can think of that we have our system described by psi of x impinging on a measurement apparatus that has a pointer on it. This is the pointer. The pointer position is given by y. And then the pointer will either swing in one direction or the other direction, depending on the state of the particle coming in. So we said that we choose the Hamiltonian so that under the Schrodinger evolution, this is the initial state of the pointer, that's given by the zero, of phi zero state, goes to some particular state if the particle we're measuring is in this A state, and you have the same thing we want to choose these two states for the measurement apparatus, for the pointer of the measurement apparatus, to be such that they're non-overlapping in position space. So if we take the magnitude of the two and multiply them together, that gives us something which is essentially zero for all y. So if you have that property for your pointer states, we can imagine if in the case where it's in state A, the pointer swings to the left, and in the case where it's in the state B, it swings to the right. If we have that property, then these things are good measurements in the de Broglie-Bohm model. And I'll explain how that works in a moment. So notice this is a much stronger condition than saying that the inner product is where you integrate over y. That's to saying that the inner product is zero. Because this can be true even if the two wave packets are mostly overlap in position. So an example would be, you know, if you have some ground states of a potential well, or the first ground state is something like this, and the second ground state is something like this, but the ground state is this, the first excited state is like that. These two states are orthogonal. In this sense, But you can see they don't satisfy this property. They will have imposition in almost everywhere. And it's interesting, in the de Broglie-Bohm model, you can consider what would happen if you had, if your pointer states consisted of states like this that did overlap in position. And then you can show there are some interesting examples where actually they don't really do, they don't perform very good measurements. There are things, there's, in the literature, if you look up and, under what's called surrealistic trajectories, you'll see there's some odd things happen. So we want this to be true. So now, if you take the total wave function of this system after, the measurement has happened, so some time t later, and you apply this evolution, then you're going to get a state like this. Now, obviously, actually, also these wave packets themselves would evolve under the sort of free evolution. Perhaps they would spread in some way. I'm not going to. We can imagine that the measurement takes place sufficiently quickly that we don't have to think about that, and we can just think, just concern ourselves with this interaction. Okay. Are there any questions at this stage? I think I'm just describing. Yep. Which one? This one here?
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, of course, in truth, it probably would be more complicated than this. I'm sort of just take, but it could be approximately this, and this is consistent with unitary evolution. So I'm just taking this as being approximately the case. But this is what you would expect if it was a good measurement device. If you send in a state corresponding to one position, then you would expect the pointer to swing to a place corresponding to that position. And if you send, so this, and likewise for the other position. So this is what you would expect. This is the way you would hope it would behave if it was a reasonably good measurement device. If you did a full detailed calculation, it may be a little bit messier than this, but essentially it would have this structure. And you can write down examples like this. I haven't given you the, there's something called the von Neumann measurement. So the von Neumann model of measurement. You didn't do that in Jormison's course, did you? Okay, so that's a model which gives you this kind of behavior. Yeah, I'm just taking that as a given. Okay. So now let's look at how this is going to, be treated in the de Broglie-Bohm model, where we also have positions x and y for the particle. This is the position of the particle that we're measuring, and this is the position of the pointer. So I'm going to try and draw a diagram to show how this will behave. And this will tax my drawing abilities yet again. No, I mean, the model, I mean, I don't know exactly how Joe taught it, but normally you write down an interaction Hamiltonian which couples the system you're measuring and the pointer, and then you just evolve unitarily using that interaction Hamiltonian, and usually you ignore the free evolution because the interaction happens very quickly. And then you can afterwards collapse if you want, if that's the interpretation you're using, but you don't have to. And in the de Broglie-Bohm model, we don't collapse. There's no actual collapse of the wave function, although we'll see that there is an effective collapse. Okay. So initially, we have two wave packets sort of in X, but the pointer is in some zero state. And the two wave packets are kind of centered like this. Okay. I need to draw some construction lines so I can indicate what I'm doing. Now let's just take this square up to the later time. Okay. Oh, that's not what I want, actually. So you have, so in at the initial time, we have kind of four quarters. Is this diagram remotely comprehensible? Yeah, I think maybe I should start all over again because I think I lost even myself. Yeah, so let's start all over again. X. This is at time zero. Y. X. I'll draw the time axis in a moment. And let's just draw a square here to help me. And divide that square into quarters. And here we have A and B. Initially, and this is the zero state for the pointer. This is the pointer. So initially, we have a wave packet which is sort of here, and another wave packet which is here. Okay. If you look at the initial state before the two systems interact, well, then the pointer is in the zero state, and the X particle is somewhere in one of these two wave packets. Okay. Now. Let's go to the later time. So I'm now going to take this square with the four quarters and draw it again at a later time. Okay. So here's the same square. And so remember, if they'd stayed where they were, the wave packets would be here. But actually, what happens is that the wave packet here, this wave packet will move into this quarter because when the Y particle interacts, the Y particle will move into this quarter. So you'll get one wave packet here. And this wave packet will move into this quarter. Okay. So the evolution of the two wave packets is going to follow something like this. This one moving back, and this one moving forwards. So the trajectories will follow, will do the same thing. The de Broglie-Bohm trajectories, any trajectories in here will just stay in the wave packets associated with them. And likewise over here. We know that because if the trajectories were to cross through here, well, there's no amplitude for the wave function in between these two places, so the particles can't really be there because they have zero probability, so they have to just stay in their own wave packets. And if you do a more detailed calculation, that's what happens. Is that picture clear? Okay. Now, so long as this condition at the top saying that the two wave packets do not overlap for the pointer, do not overlap in the y coordinate. So long as that condition remains true, these two wave packets will just carry on separately. Okay. One way that if your pointer is, as is typical in real experiments, if your pointer consists of many, many particles, so y1, y2, up to yn, where n is so a big number like 10 to the 23, roughly Avogadro's number. This is what you'd expect for a physical pointer because it's a macroscopic system. So if this is true, then we expect that for all later times, this condition, this non-overlapping condition, will continue to be true. Now, it's possible in principle that you could imagine some evolution on a system, no matter how complicated that system was, that would bring these wave packets back together, even though they didn't overlap. But for normal physical systems like pointers, that would be extremely difficult to implement. You'd have to be sure to get the detailed wave function of each of the particles in here, each of the m particles, to overlap again, and that would be extremely difficult to perform. So for sort of thermodynamic kinds of reasons, you wouldn't really be able to bring the two wave packets together. So this is a fairly safe assumption. Okay. You can understand what, sorry? Well, if you were an experimentalist trying to bring together these two wave packets after they had separated, if it's just one particle, you could imagine just carefully, you know, subjecting it to some potential that would bring those two wave packets into the same region again. But if you've got 10 to the 23 particles, then you'd have to carefully find a way to get each of those 10 to the 23 particles to overlap again. It's just impractical to do that. This would especially be the case, incidentally, if this pointer was also interacting with molecules in the air around. So those particles also in the air would also have to be brought back into their original positions. So for sort of practical reasons, it's very difficult to reverse this kind of evolution for large systems. Okay, we can talk about it later if you want to. Okay. So what does that mean for the evolution of these trajectories? So imagine that you're in one of the two wave packets. For example, over here, we can consider the velocity of the system in configuration space. And this is given by some function of the wave function, depending also on its first derivative, evaluated at the particular position the trajectory is in. And I'm not writing down the full expression, but you remember it from before. Well, we can see that this is going to be equal, more or less exactly, to this, where this is the effective wave function, and it's given by this. So if y is in the support of the A wave packet, then you can just take the A term from that wave function as your effective wave function. And likewise, if it's in the B, if it's in the support of the B wave packet, then you can take as your effective wave function in this expression the B part. And because you're only evaluating the wave function at or in the vicinity, if you consider the first derivatives, of the positions x and y, and these two wave packets are non-overlapping, if y is in the support of the A part, it doesn't really care what's happening to this wave packet. You'll get the same trajectory as whatever you have here. So so you have you can work with this effective wave function. Certainly, if you were going to do the calculation, it would be a lot easier to just take this effective wave function. So you have effective collapse. Now, in the ontology, you don't have any real collapse. The wave function in the de Broglie-Bohm ontology continues to be this thing. This is part of the ontic state. But for all practical purposes, it's sufficient to work with this effective wave function if you're calculating the trajectories using the guidance equation. Are there any questions?
I'm not so clear why the effective wave function works properly.
So when you calculate, so I'm not going to write down again the expression, but you have it in your notes. When you calculate the velocity using that wave function, and then afterwards you substitute in x equals x and y equals y, that expression doesn't care. That expression is only going to care about the part of the wave packet that you're in. It won't see, if you just do the calculation, you'll see that it doesn't matter what you have over here. So you have to calculate, in order to calculate the velocity of the trajectory in configuration space, you need to know this and this, okay? And then you need to evaluate these at okay, and that gives you a number. This gives you a number. This gives you a number, okay? Now, if x and y are in the support of the A, sorry, if just y is in the support of the A wave packet, then the number you get here only cares about this expression here. And likewise, when you take the gradient, the number you get here only cares about this part. Oh, and incidentally, the normalization doesn't matter because you're dividing in the equation for the guidance formula, you have this normalization. You divide out, so it doesn't matter if you have some constant in front, here and here. Okay. So the key point is, although you don't have actual physical collapse of the wave function, you have effective collapse and the future evolution of the system behaves as if the wave function had collapsed in the de Broglie model. And that was one of Bohm's key contributions to this, to show how measurement works. Are there any more questions on this?
How do we interpret wave functions in this
moment? So there's some difficult questions, and I'll come to those in a few minutes. But let me just explain what the issue is. Imagine if the trajectory was in here. Well, this is still the wave function, but we have both terms in it. But this is only this part of the wave function is influencing the trajectory. But you still have this. And this is still real, but it's not influencing the trajectory. So the question. So there's a problem there that you have. And if you had a more complicated system, you could have a lot of interesting structure in what you might call the empty wave packet. And so I'll talk about some of the problems that gives rise to later. I'll use the word zombies, so watch out for that. Okay. So the de Broglie-Bohm model is explicitly non-local. If you have two particles, x1 and x2, then you look at the velocity of one of those two particles, v1, then you can see v1 depends on x2. So if you could imagine jiggling the position of particle 2, then that would instantaneously influence the velocity of particle 1. And you might ask, well, how could you actually jiggle particle X2? This, after all, is a completely deterministic model. You could imagine jiggling X2 in the following way. If the two particles, if there's some Schrodinger equation and there's some potential that acts on particle 2, well, then you could vary the potential acting on particle 2. And that would have an influence on the wave function, which would cause particle 2 to be moved around. And then you would end up influencing the trajectory of particle 1. So just by varying the potential acting only on system 2, you can cause the velocity of particle 1 to be changed. And you see this explicitly when you look at examples. So it's interesting that this fact about the Broglie-Bohm model was John Bell's motivation to see if hidden variable interpretations had to be non-local in general. So he saw that the de Broglie-Bohm model had this particular feature, which is in some ways very unappealing, And then he constructed a theorem showing that actually this has to be true in general for any realistic interpretation of quantum theory. In fact, one of the great things about the de Broglie-Bohm model is that even if you don't believe it to be the correct interpretation of quantum theory, and I certainly don't myself, nevertheless, it has lots of interesting properties, and those can motivate you to think, you know, to try to study it, to see if there are theorems that can be proven. So more recently, there's the PBR theorem showing that the wave function has to be a real thing. Well, if you trace that back through literature, that question was motivated by seeing that in the de Broglie-Bohm model, the wave function is indeed a real thing. It's part of the ontology. So then you can ask, well, does that have to be true for any interpretation? And there are other questions you can ask. There are specific features of the de Broglie-Bohm model that you can ask whether they are general properties for any interpretation. Okay. Here's a few points about this model. If you have a system, a wave function consisting of two particles, and those two particles are initially in a product state, and remain in a product state for the duration of the evolution that you're interested in, then you can show that you don't have this non-local effect. You need entanglement to have this non-local effect. That follows from the guidance equation. So when you do the calculation, you can see that, in fact, it's almost immediately obvious that the dependence on the phi part just drops out. So the de Broglie-Bohm model is local for product states. Another point is, in the case where you do have an entangled state, the de Broglie-Bohm model is non-local. And you might think, well, perhaps you can use that to signal faster than the speed of light. In fact, you obviously can't, because the de Broglie-Bohm model reproduces all the statistical projections, all the statistical predictions of quantum theory, and you can't use violation of Bell's theorem to signal faster than light. But if in the de Broglie-Bohm model you are out of equilibrium, so if rho is not equal to psi squared, then actually you can signal faster than the speed of light in this model. And this is due to Valentini.
you said if it starts at the equilibrium very quickly, it goes into.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. And if you want to be able to continue to use this, you have to try and keep it in away from equilibrium. So this is a hard thing to actually see. Yeah.
Has anyone done calculations to see whether it would be possible to do in the lab? How far out of equilibrium?
Well, the problem is you need a source of systems that you believe are out of equilibrium, and you know, most likely everything you have in a laboratory has been interacting for so long with everything else that it would be in equilibrium according to the Tabori-Bohm model. So Valentini proposes that you could imagine trying to take particles that haven't interacted very much since the early universe. He thinks of neutrinos as a possibility, cosmic neutrinos, or particles that come from a place where you think maybe quantum theory is wrong. So perhaps because of the effects of quantum gravity, if you're in the vicinity of a black hole, perhaps you'll have particles that are not in equilibrium, and try to take those and use them as a source of this kind of thing. So he's done a lot of careful calculations and detailed study of this sort of phenomena. So his strong belief is that quantum theory is just an equilibrium theory, and that the true fundamental theory is something deeper, which will have all these kinds of effects in it. No. Any other questions? Okay. Yep.
Say x1, x2, the two particles are distributed according to rho squared.
According to psi squared. Yeah.
Does that mean that the particle x1 is distributed according to the trace of the partial density matrix?
So the de Broglie-Bohm model cares about whether you have a pure or a mixed state. And strictly speaking, really, the calculation is always done for pure states. So you assume that you expand out. You find a system which is big enough that you can assume it is in a pure state, or at least a system which is big enough that that you have effectively a product state with the rest of the universe. So you could have an effective state and your system, such like that. So then if you have a density matrix, I'm giving a longer answer to your question than you perhaps want. If you have a density matrix, for a density matrix, there's many different ways of taking a convex combination of taking a mixture of a pure states to get that density matrix. Any given density matrix, there are infinitely many ways. But in the de Broglie-Bohm model, you would have to choose the right way because it would have to be the one that corresponded to the appropriate entangled state. And remember, position is special, so there is some special basis picked out. The distribution and then you would have a probabilistic mixture of many different pure states acting on this system. And for each of those pure states, you would get the right, you'd get rho equal to psi squared. And then the total sum of all those effects would be what you said. It would be that the distribution was given by the trace measure. But the density matrices aren't a very natural object in the de Broglie-Bohm model. So let me give you some criticisms of the de Broglie-Bohm model. Well, first of all, one problem the model has is that you don't need the guidance equation to actually predict probabilities. And since you don't need it, no one's likely to actually use the de Broglie model to calculate, to make predictions for any practical situation. And in fact, it's more complicated to use the guidance formula because then you have to do all this extra calculation and you're going to get the same answer that you would get anyway without using the guidance formula. These remarks are true if you're in equilibrium. If you're not in equilibrium, then of course that wouldn't be true. And in that case, the de Broglie model would make predictions that disagreed with standard quantum theory. The second criticism is to ask, where does this guidance equation come from? It's kind of a bolt-on. So you have, you know, Schrodinger's equation, which works perfectly well, as I just said. And then you say, well, you know, but there's these reasons I want to also have the guidance equation to satisfy my demand to solve the measurement problem to provide a picture. So you have this extra equation, just a bolt-on. And you might say, well, you know, a more natural approach would be to derive all the equations of the de Broglie model, the Schrodinger equation, and the guidance equation from some deeper considerations. If you could show that those equations came from some deeper principles, then the guidance equation would look more natural. But as it is, you just take the Schrodinger equation, which works perfectly well by itself, and then demand that there's this guidance equation for various interpretational reasons. A third criticism is that there's no back reaction of the particles on the wave function. So regardless of the, you know, the wave function continues to evolve according to the Schrodinger equation, regardless of what the particles do. And that's unusual in physics. Normally, different parts of your you know, different aspects of your physical system will interact with each other. In a sense, this just underlines these two previous points. You don't need the guidance equation to predict probabilities. It's not clear where it comes from, and anyway, it has no influence on the wave function. And then the fourth attack, or the criticism, let's call it an attack. I'm going to go somewhere over here. The fourth one is the many worlds in denial attack. So I'm going to talk about the many worlds after I finish talking about the de Broglie model. This is due to people like David Deutsch. And then there's a paper by Harvey Brown and David Wallace. And so let me give you the many worlds in denial attack. So the basic idea is that the de Broglie model is actually just the many worlds interpretation, and it's trying to pretend it isn't. So in the de Broglie model, the wave function is real. I mean, in the ontological sense, I don't mean that it's not imaginary, or it's got no imaginary components. I mean that it's a real thing. It's a real thing. So this means that any empty waves, any empty wave packets are also real. So I just erased the picture that had the examples of empty waves. But if the particles live in this wave packet, nevertheless, this wave packet continues to be real. And as you evolve it according to the Schrodinger equation. And this empty wave packet contains, well, everything. It contains a complete story of the world. It contains tables and chairs and people and buildings and, well, you name it. It contains value mart. It contains everything is there in the empty wave packet. And it's very easy to make an empty wave packet. What you do is you take a qubit. You can imagine that just a particle that can be in one or two positions. And then, so this could be the qubit. And then you entangle it. So then you make a measurement. Okay, if you see, and then this could be the outcome of the measurement. And it could also have the rest of the universe. So that's everything else. So this could be, you know, this is the term that contains value mass and everything else. I need a symbol for that. I waste a lot of time trying to think of symbols for things. If I rest, there we go. So now we have, this part. So we perform a measurement, we get an outcome, and we have everything here. And then we have another thing, which is empty. And after a while, this would evolve in a different way to this one, because people will learn about the outcome of this measurement and discuss it, and perhaps some building contractor will decide to build a building which will be influenced by this outcome or not. So this term may have a whole building, a whole new section of Waterloo may come up here, but not here. But nevertheless, inside the empty wave packet, there's all the structure of the world, all the stuff happening is in there. But if you want to think of the de Broglie-Bohm model as a solution to the measurement problem, you have to believe it's kind of not as real. But somehow the real story is the one where the particles are. And the stuff that's happening in the empty wave packet isn't as real. So the people that live in the empty wave packet are zombies or mindless hulks. They can't attack you because they can't jump across from here to here. But they are they're not as real. At least you have to believe they're somehow not as real as the people living in the wave packet that has the particle in it. And this is kind of a problem. I'm not a philosopher, but there's a sort of philosophical idea called functionalism. It's often used in the discussion of consciousness. So if you have the various atoms in our brain, carbon and other things that sort of make and in there there's a process happening and that gives rise to consciousness. Well, if you can emulate the same process somewhere else, say inside a computer where perhaps the atoms are different, the silicon and other kinds of things, but the process is the same, then the argument, according to functionalism, is that that would also be conscious. But what really matters is that you have some real stuff doing something. Well, in the de Broglie-Bohm model, this empty wave packet is still part of the ontology, so it is real stuff, and it's doing something. So why wouldn't it be real? Just because it doesn't have the extra sort of dazzle factor of having a particle in it doesn't mean it's not real. It's very hard to maintain the position that something is real but not as real. It makes no sense. So that's the problem. The problem is that the many worlds in denial attack is the claim that people who believe in the de Broglie-Bohm model are just denying this other stuff is real and it contains a world. So really, the particle position, the x and the y, are essentially irrelevant. All the real structure is in the wave function. Okay. Any questions on that? I just want to write the word zombies on the blackboard. Okay. So you can think of this as being, this sort of crosstalk between the de Broglie-Bohm, people who study the de Broglie-Bohm model and the people who work on the many worlds approach as being like there's two great battleships at sea. And this is the people who work on the many worlds approach firing a torpedo at the de Broglie-Bohm model battleship, sinking it before they themselves sink under the weight of their own excess baggage, excess ontological baggage, as I'll discuss in the next lecture. So that's everything I have to say on the de Broglie-Bohm model. Are there any questions at this stage?
How do support the de Broglie-Bohm model defend themselves for the currency?
How do you support it?
Yeah. How do they defend their argument for the
right? So I think these first three criticisms aren't so worrying. I mean, you can say, well, so the first criticism you can say, well, sure, you don't need it to calculate probabilities, but if you want to understand what's going on, then you need to solve the measurement problem. So this is fine. The second problem is, the second question is, well, you can just say, well, I don't need to say where it comes from. Here's an equation. I believe it's correct. Or perhaps even if it isn't exactly correct, perhaps the world is something like this. And so it's not such a problem. And likewise, the fact that there's no back reaction, you can say, well, okay, that was a feature of classical physics, but this is quantum theory, and not all the features of classical physics have to go through. So I think these problems are not so serious. This problem, on the other hand, I think is a very serious problem. I think and I'm trying to remember. So definitely Anthony Valentini, you can find this on the internet somewhere, has defended the de Broglie-Bohm model against the many worlds attack. There was a conference the Everett interpretation, the many worlds interpretation I'm going to talk about next, was the initial paper was written in 1957. And so a few years ago, there was a conference in 2007 celebrating 50 years. And there were two conferences. There were two conferences. One was held here at Perimeter, and you can watch that on PERSA. And the other one was held in Oxford. And the videos for that are available online somewhere. Anthony Valentini gives a talk defending the de Broglie-Bohm model against this particular attack. I can't remember the essential point he made right now. For me, it's a very serious problem. So I think, I don't know how to defend it. Any other questions? Yeah.
Can particles go faster than light in the relativistic extension of this?
So in the relativistic extension, normally first of all, there are many different relativistic extensions. Different approaches people have taken over the years. Most of those have fields, so the basic ontology is that you have some field configuration, so real fields. So if it was electromagnetism, you would have electromagnetic fields everywhere. And just like in this, you have a definite particle position. There, you would have a definite field configuration. But then you have a Schrodinger equation. So the Schrodinger equation in that case gives you an amplitude for each field configuration, and it evolves according to some, you know, the wave function evolves according to some Schrodinger equation. So it's a harder question: does the do the fields move faster than light because they're not particles, they're fields?
But they don't follow the classical equations of motion.
No, they don't. Yeah, they follow some other equations of motion, because in the de Broglie-Bohm model, in this model. The particles, well, they can in principle move faster than light because you don't have relativistic equations, but they tend to move at this, you know, they tend to move locally. They don't tend not to move too fast if you're looking in a normal regime, as long as your wave functions don't have energy components that are too high. In that model, it's a harder question to ask. But nevertheless, suddenly it's a non-local model. So suddenly if you jiggle something over here, you'll get some jiggling over there as well. So that non-local feature is going to be there in any of these models. But that's more of an informational influence than it is actually something moving faster than the speed of light. Yeah.
Is there any prediction that can help us distinguish between the interpretations?
So if you could show that there was some non-equilibrium matter, so some source of systems that that were out of equilibrium in this sense, then you'd be able to do things like signal faster than light, or just violate quantum theory in all sorts of different ways. But there's no reason to believe that has to be the case, or if it is the case, there's no reason to believe it's very easy to find such stuff. So so that's just a matter of luck. If you find something like that, then of course you would prove this, and these people would be very happy. The many worlds interpretation is really just standard quantum theory without projection anywhere. So it's difficult to distinguish it from, I mean, it's difficult to know. It doesn't make predictions that are different from quantum theory. There's collapse models. So in those models, you actually, I'll talk about those after I finish talking about the many worlds. In those models, you actually change the Schrodinger equation. You actually modify the dynamics. And those models do lead to predictions. The violations of quantum theory, so you could, in principle, look for those, and there were various proposals. But there's no distinction experimentally between the de Broglie-Bohm model and the many worlds interpretation. As long as rho is equal to psi squared, then there's no way you could distinguish the two interpretations. Any more questions? No? Okay. So tomorrow I'll start on the many worlds interpretation. The people working on the many worlds interpretation are recently, they're generally philosophers. So the style of argumentation is going to be kind of different.